That's the oxygen this entire industry breathes, and it's completely sacred. We have to do everything by a fan-first experience.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast, where my partner, Joe Favorito, and I talk about the business of sports with all different kinds of folks from the industry. And we try to do that as regularly as we can, typically weekly. It's been a little trickier these last couple months because of the lockdown. But here we are, Joe, for another show. You ready to go?
Yep. And we just want to, so we don't seem like we're tone deaf, Tom. We're taping this towards the end of August. There's obviously a lot of things going on in sports, bubble, not bubble. NFL hasn't been back yet, but we're not going to really address those because we don't know when you're listening to it, and we certainly don't want to sound outdated. So we want to be neither outdated nor obtuse. So we're not going to ignore the whole thing.
But today we're going to be talking about a couple of interesting topics, that one of which we haven't really talked about in earnest, I don't think ever, Joe, in the podcast, and that's about women in sports technology and the group Women in Sports Tech, WIST. And we're going to talk about what this the founder of this company calls the new age of sponsorship measurement. Very dramatic statement. This has been a big issue, as Joe and I have learned on the academic side. We now have lots of business analytics courses, business intelligence courses, et cetera. This has been a really interesting development in the last few years. It's a competitive space. And there's a player out there, a really interesting company out of the DC area called Zoomf, which was co-founded by our guest today, Amir Zanozi. Amir, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Excited to be here with you, gentlemen.
Yeah. So the big question is, Joe, where do we start? Because we want to get into all these topics.
Well, there's definitely a story about George Mason basketball that we want to hear.
Yes. So we're
both Mason and Georgetown.
Right. Yeah, so if there's an arcane basketball reference to be found in a podcast, Joe will find it like no other. And he already found that even in the warm-up to recording the show. Yeah. So Amir, let's just quickly get to know you a little bit. Talk a little bit about your background. I know it does start at George Mason and continue through Georgetown into the software business and social media business and the founding of Zoomf. So give us a couple minutes on where this all started.
Yeah, I'll make it quick and as painless as possible. But, background is grew up, everyone's watching The Last Dance. That's when I was growing up. That was some of the best times of my life. You know, I was watching WGN on television with my family, just the Bulls. My dad was a doctor. He taught at Georgetown Medicine School, and I would play on the courts there. You know, met Mutombo's nephews, met Allen Iverson, John Thompson back in the day. And I was just hooked with basketball. I loved it. And so the George Mason reference, when undergrad, during, what was it? Was it 2007? They were, in the Final Four. We lived in a house that was quite a party house. Names will not be mentioned. But, I come back from a night partying outside, watching a game, come back late and come to find that there's cars parked all the way down the street and music blaring. We had a house of seven guys that were living in it. So you can imagine. And the entire George Mason basketball team was throwing a party at our house. One athlete was like in my room, like listening to music and everything with a bunch of people in there. I was like, what? It was the most awesome experience. I mean, the vibe at that moment in the Final Four, there was nothing like it. Still not a fan of Joe Kim Noah to this day because of everything. But it was so profound. It was impactful. In that area, I've always grown up in the Northern Virginia area. And so, we're talking about Georgetown and my grad school and what I was doing there. That was all, the relation, I'll kind of go into the story of Zoomf if that's okay with you guys and just make it quick. Yeah. So my entire existence has always been untraditional, right? My parents wanted me to go into medicine. That wasn't me. Tried a bunch of things. But the one thing that really stuck out to me was social media. And AOL at the time had come out with the product AIM. And I was obsessed about it because, a little bit of an introvert at the time and talking through the keyboard was a lot easier. And I met all my friends and I'd come up with these witty buddy lists and away messages anyways. Going through undergrad, there was nothing really out there that really spoke to me as a student at the time. And what I obsessed about was the psychology, which was my undergrad, of connecting with people, meeting the signal to the receiver. I argue social media is more psychology than it is technology. Mm-hmm. And this program at Georgetown, I was freelancing at the time, working from senators to pest control, whatever, anyone that would pay for social media, I would do it. And at Georgetown, there was an opportunity to
skip that. Who were anybody successful? The names that you want to throw out there, you'd rather not.
So. Yeah, rather not. But you know, at the time it was new. There was no rules. It was the Wild West of social. It's still the Wild West, right? But and Joe, the crazy thing is there was a time I was at a bar. It was Clyde's in Tyson's Corner. It's no longer there. And I was giving advice to my friends on social media to what to do for their businesses, for wherever they work. One of the guys there was like, you got to come and meet Ali, who's, the CEO at Zoom for MetroStar at the time. At the time, it was MetroStar. He's like, we're looking for people in social media. So I was like, what do they work on? He's like, government. I was like, that's not my thing. That kind of sounds boring. He's like, they pay well. And I was like, all right, I'll come there next week. And so where Zoom began was we were actually helping understand the impact of social media in Arab Spring and areas outside of the country before, during, and after speeches. Nothing to do with sports, right? Completely different. But they would keep asking us these questions on like, hey, how do we remove people that are not related to politics and government and federal? And how do we find that influence? So we started building things. I mean, we did stuff like tweet walls behind President Obama, and we do fan engagement, fan experiences. And when we first, when Ali, our CEO, first heard about it, it was during a meeting with the State Department. They were like, hey, we love this product that you guys built. And he was like, what product? And so he came, had a meeting with us. He's like, what are you guys doing over here? And we showed him that the tools that we had at the time weren't able to allow us to do what we needed to get the job done. So we started building our own tools, don't look behind the curtains, duct tape, smoke, everything. And he was like, guys, this is never going to work at the government at the time, because this was, it wasn't where it was today. And he's like, you guys can work nights and weekends. We'll work with security. You guys can come into the building whenever you want. And if it becomes something, you guys can be co-founders. We'll launch it. I'll help you guys guide this ship out. And so we just obsessively worked night and day over it. And we started, working for free. We got our name out there. And then we got a chance with Monumental Sports to work with the Capitals at the time. Shout out to Mike Hutchinson, Joe DePriest, Greg Roberts, some of the older names at the organization. We started working with them. We were doing fan experiences. So there would be a social media experience. You go on ice, you throw a hashtag or mention, be on the center screen. Cool stuff. But we started doing this for everyone, Coca-Cola, everything, and we started experimenting, getting analytics. If you were at the Orioles game and it was center field, we realized you don't have to say take a selfie. If you only approve selfies on these visuals, people start popping up like lemmings, right? And so we're like, how can we show that we're shifting the behavior of how people act and react in the analytics behind this? And that kind of put us through a journey until around 2018 is when the Dallas Cowboys were like, we don't want to use you guys for marketing. We want to use you guys for partnerships.
Wow.
And we said no. And they said, F you, we're the Cowboys. And we said, yes, you are. Let's do it. And, that started with that instance. And, we always listen to our customers. That's what kind of guided us. But, that we hit MSG, we started working with other organizations, and we found our niche. We didn't realize this going out, but we had perfectly built the system for it. But it took us pivoting and moving around, failing multiple times, right? Not like hard failure, but just like not getting massive success at the moment. But these last couple of years have been fantastic for us. And it was a very long answer, and I'll shut up for, but that was, I appreciate you guys letting me hear that out. Yeah.
Before you do that, talk a little bit about what the social, and you talked about the Arab Spring and some of the things that you saw. That social engagement, I guess it was on Twitter at that point, right? But what were the tools that you used then to measure and track engagement and create engagement that were different then that they are now? And how has that evolved into the sponsorship measurement side?
Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, you're good at this, Joe. So basically, we created an algorithm. So at the time, there was a platform called Clout. If you remember back in the day, it was kind of popularity.
That was one of those things that was there. And then people said, this doesn't work. And it disappeared.
Exactly. And so for us, that's where it started for us. We were like, this doesn't work for us because And believe it or not, Justin Bieber mentioned the words that we were searching for, and he was number one on the report that we were going to hand into Steamer. One, it's Bieber. Two, he's Canadian. And so that we were like, we gotta work on this. And so that first night, we manually removed people that did not contextually make sense to the conversation. And then that put us on this journey where we created this algorithm called Z points. It's basically like a weighted score. And what we did was we weighed follower count low. We weighed number of times people posted low, but we weighted engagement very high. So if people are retweeting it, people are commenting on it. And we looked at how do we let the voice of the people boost the type of content we should be seeing. We did it on a post by post basis. So, and you guys are going to roll your eyes. I mean, you remember Fire Festival or was it Fire Island? Right? Those major influencers. The best documentaries ever. Yeah, take them to the pigs, Ja Rule said. But basically,
best two documentaries.
we got double the
fun.
Exactly. And you know, we looked at that situation. Those were, you know, your typical influencers that make something go viral. Well, there was a guy that had less than 100 followers that took a picture of his lunch tray that took the whole thing down. Right? Yeah. He was not your typical influencer, and that's why we did a post by post basis. Because we wanted to look at something that might have come from not that he's a nobody, but a nobody in terms of influencer mindset, and say, even his content, if it's the perfect formula, if it's the perfect recipe at the right time, how can we kind of track that? But I mean, that you know, Joe, it's constantly kind of being able to solve and answer what, you know, our clients were asking us, and what was challenges for us to really surface that insight to show that impact that people are making.
Cool.
Hey, Amir, I have a question. As each new platform, because you've been around 6 years, you said, or so?
Yep.
7 years?
Yep.
Yeah. So you've, let's take TikTok as the darling of social media right now as an example. So they were Musical.ly, at least in the US, was Musical.ly, and then it turned into TikTok, and then it just started to catch on fire. And sure. It's been the, you know, arguably the hottest thing of the last year on social media. So when a new platform becomes that important, do you guys do a kind of bottoms up review of the platform and the nature of the interactions, the kind of the whole dynamic around its usage to determine what you're going to do vis-a-vis the Zoom measurement approaches?
Yeah, Tom. I mean, so a couple of things to address that, because, you know, some philosophies that we have that not all engagement is created equal, not all impressions are created equal, and different platforms are different aspects of people's personas. Like, mm-hmm. you know, LinkedIn Joe is different than TikTok Joe, right? So like, right. But we look at that as an expression in different demographics that go and engage with it. But the number one thing, and before I even go there, I mean, like, amazing job by their algorithm, and they're collecting a lot of data, right? To be able to, you know, market it to you in perfection. And what I love about TikTok is the FYP, the For You page, that is broadcasting for the next, you know, generation. That is mobile television served to you. You don't have to follow anyone. Every all of these other platforms, you have to do an action to start pulling in that newsfeed of people. Mm-hmm. They're saying, no, here you go. Here's someone that you should look at. And by the way, this is because of how you're interacting with what you're looking at, I'm going to show you more of this. Because you're passing on this other content, I'm going to show you less of this. It's just so well you know, and the one thing that they did not perfect, you know, with science and everything that they did to that algorithm, they didn't perfect the politics behind, you know, getting platforms like this out there, and they went too late, right? The CEO mayor just resigned. And it's interesting to see what this is. It's the first foreign-based social platform that's going viral, per se, if you will. It's addicting. I mean, I'm on it. I mean, the amount of time, and it's Vine. It's Vine if Twitter had treated Vine right? Like, it could have been that, but they didn't. And so I think it's absolutely fascinating. You know, I'd love to, and here's the number one thing that no one thinks about. All of this stuff is based on the APIs and the developer ecosystem around these different platforms. Twitter famously dropped the ball with their developers, with Dick Costello, and then, you know, we have Jack come back, and he brought that relationship, and now they're thriving again. It's the developers that really, that ecosystem that help take that technology from these platforms and provide actionable insights and actionable ways of processing this data to drive business decisions. What TikTok doesn't have is an API that's out there. Now you can share TikTok from other platforms. You can, now they're going to start advertising. They just had an advanced analytics for business accounts, but they don't have an analytics platform that's out. You can download the Excel, and some companies are like taking the CSV and uploading in, but that's not a real API. Doesn't update. You have to do that systematically. So that's the one caveat, that we won't touch a platform if it doesn't have an API. And that's because in this business, you can't afford to have stale data. You know, it's just data that starts to become stale, starts ruining the types of decisions that you're making. And with TikTok, I mean, I love it as a fan personally. I was hoping it would get to a point where there was an API. There's politics involved. There's data privacy and security involved. And so we're watching, we're waiting, and we're, you know, very anxious to see what happens with it. You're seeing that they just integrated with Alexa. That might be a clue to who just entered the dance, right, with Bezos. So, mm-hmm. and today, Walmart's even throwing their hat in the ring. So there's a lot of people that are interested, but there's a lot of data in there that's very fascinating and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Amir, just do us the audience a favor. We've used the term, and we've heard the term API mentioned a few times in this podcast, but just a quick definition for the listeners as to what that really means in what you're describing.
Yeah, 100%, Tom. So basically, an API is a set of rules that the platform provides developers to use their data with. And so you can get their data and integrate it into your system, but you've got to play by the rules in order to process that data and pull it.
In this case, like Zoom, you use the word developer, but in this case, it's Zoom for measurement business.
Yeah, for us.
You need that. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So we've got APIs with all the major platforms. We've got partnerships. Some of the APIs are private. Some of them are public. Anyone can access them. Some of them we're paying for, right? Twitter, their data licensing is doing better than their ads. And so like, maybe not, I don't know, but they're licensing this data. And if you're familiar with it, historic Twitter data is very expensive to acquire as well. So they're making businesses and revenue from the data that's coming out of their platforms. And as we saw with Cambridge Analytica, it's incredibly impactful with what you can do with the amount of data these platforms have.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's actually really helpful to hear that. And I guess you stopped me for a second when you mentioned that you were thinking that Twitter might have as much or more revenue with the data sale as with the advertising. I suppose it could get to that point as this becomes more and more important to all the constituents you serve, such as in sports, teams, leagues, brands that support sports, agencies, et cetera. You get enough customers, that's some big data consumption ongoing, you know, kind of a recurring thing, never ends. So that could be a really big revenue driver for these companies. I haven't really thought about that because I think most of us default to thinking, oh, they're just using our data to make the advertising hyper-targeted, which makes it more valuable in the market. And that's obviously made Google a trillion-dollar company. So do you want to say anything more about that? Or is that just something that you think will continue to grow?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing. I'm looking at where we are right now, and pandemic is heightened, right? And it catalyzed trends. It just made things happen faster. But I'm seeing sports teams and their digital teams act more like in-house agencies on behalf of the brands that come and partner with them. They specialize in understanding how to best engage their fan base. And ads don't work the way they used to, right? The best way an ad works is you don't exactly know it's an ad, where it's a weaved into the narrative. It's an effort that is, you saw with The Last Dance, they had, you know, Hershey's and Facebook, and the ads that they had were compelling enough that they were part of the story. And I'm looking at this as, another thing is sports teams need to stop acting like event companies and more like media companies. I don't look at sports as the product. I look at sports as the platform, and the product is the branded experience that they create for their different audiences. Now, the data from social media that we're getting provided, exactly like you said, hyper-targeted, we want to understand, because look, audiences and fan bases are not homogeneous. There are different reasons why you and I watch these games. And it might be because I want to go with my family. I want to go and maybe it's an HR experience. I want to take people out from work, or maybe, you know, right now it's different with the pandemic, but we're all connecting for different reasons. The teams, you know, some people have stronger relationships to their teams than they do with their own religion, right? And it's that powerful, the relationship that they have. And so, you know, what we try to best understand is, why are those reasons that those fans are engaging and interacting? We anonymize and we aggregate it, but we look at the different behaviors that we're seeing and we group and segment them so that we understand. Because, you know, markets are competitive. You know, you look at New York and LA within sports. How can one fan base show that there's more quality within this one audience segment that matches the target audience of a brand? And so that's how we're kind of looking at this in a different way, where these are platforms that we can use to better engage and interact with these fan bases. And there's no better relationship than with the team's arm around a brand saying, this is our official partner. Here's some exclusive access that you're going to get on because of this brand that is facilitating this experience. And so all that data is just helping us realize all of this needs to be fan-driven. And we look at fan-driven partnerships as the aspect of how partnership deals should be made. There's pre-existing relationships. We don't need to shove a logo and slap a logo on. Why don't we look at our audience and see where that existence of relationships already are, bring that in, pour jet fuel on it, make it something much bigger than it already is, and run it by the fans, because that's the oxygen this entire industry breathes, and it's completely sacred. We have to do everything by a fan-first experience.
All right, so Amir, it sounds like things have been really well the last few years, and this year I know in particular, esports has been a real growth area. Talk about that. What is exactly going on from your perspective in the world of esports and measurement?
Yeah, it's fascinating. They, you know, esports and sports have a lot in common, and they have a lot that are not in common, of course. And they're both, you know, there's both can learn a lot from each other. One thing I'm learning right now is like the first party data kind of world and understanding, you know, collecting information and personalizing the experiences. You know, Team Liquid just came out with the Liquid Plus program, and you're seeing that they're kind of moving in that direction. But that historically hasn't happened in esports. But
can you explain that? What does that mean? What is the Liquid Plus program?
Sure. So they're basically wanting to understand their fans and how they engage with them better. And when they buy merch and they interact with them and they share their content, they should know who their super fans are. And so they're creating this opt-in program where you can sign up and be sort of a Liquid Plus member. And what that does is that all your interactions with the team are now recorded in a way so that those top engaged fans are receiving more experiences, more personalization around their fan experience. So this is new. There's nothing been like this. And, you know, sports teams and have had, you know, ways of kind of doing this, but this is a new approach. And that's like an impact of, I think, traditional sports to esports. But it's a different world. Like, you know, in esports, they typically celebrate when a partner comes in. And, you know, one thing that we've been helping them sort of understand is, what is the value, you know, of that? If you're watching like 100 Thieves and there's a Warzone weekend tournament with Chipotle and Cash App, they've got logos kind of spin. They want to know the value of that. It's a little bit different with how their players and live streamers relationship works. It's more like NCAA. So they can get members of their team in part of the activations that they do. Right now, you know, you do a deal with the Browns, you're not really doing a deal with the Browns, and they can say, well, Odell Beckham's going to do these things for you in that kind of way. And this, so they have that ability to do that, and we're able to have them authenticate and understand the impact that every streamer sort of makes on behalf of the team as well. And it's a different type of media play, but it's fantastic to kind of see. And there's this surge of non-endemic partners that are entering into esports, especially at, you know, with the pandemic. But League of Legends, the 2019 World Championship that they had, Louis Vuitton was coming, and no one would have realized that there was a high luxury clothing brand, you know, that had an affinity with esports until they did that. And they're following the model of what they did with FIFA and the trophy case. But, you know, it's a very different world, and it's very fascinating and interesting. And what we're doing is we're basically providing that partnership ROI information across all of their different digital experiences, and then understanding that value and in real time providing dollar signs to that exposure media value that they're providing. And then more importantly, it goes back to that audience side. Who's interacting? How are they interacting? What kind of engagement? What are the other types of brands they have relationships with? And how do we monitor that sort of success that they're having?
Great. And Amir, on that front, what are the top platforms that you're seeing for the clients that you have in esports? Twitch, YouTube Gaming, et cetera. Could you just run down that list?
Yeah. So, RIP Mixer, Microsoft is out of the race and we're seeing a surge mm-hmm. now go to Facebook Gaming, but really the main player is Twitch and YouTube. Now they're all on Discord where they're creating communities and engaging. We're going to see a lot more activity around Discord data very soon. I'm very sure of it. Twitter is where a lot of them are just like real time in sports, interacting, engaging, commenting on it. You're seeing very little, but not a lot on Instagram, and Facebook is, they don't even, look at Facebook. It's not a platform in their eyes. And there's a lot of other platforms that are out there that are video platforms that are, different networks. I'm sorry, you had a question.
Yeah. So are you able to access first party environments like Epic Games, Fortnite, for example, which is really important in that world?
Yeah, so we're not working with the developers yet. The developers definitely hold the most power within the ecosystem. And what fascinates me and where I want to be is understand what is the value of Travis Knight doing a concert or Marshmello doing a concert in Fortnite, and what is that AR play that might happen as a result of it. And it's funny, we're going through those battles with Apple and Epic Games, but now the social media networks are looking at Epic as a competitor because a lot of people are spending their free time. Me, myself, mm-hmm. personally, I'm catching up with my friends on Call of Duty over the weekend, and we're just playing games mm-hmm. and talking. We were even talking about doing that for meetings, internal meetings, just playing Call of Duty and just catching up on stuff. And it's this new digital hangout that we're kind of existing on. It's kind of like Slack, but you're playing a game at the same time. And it's just such a fast-paced moving world. But it's interesting. Yeah. And there's all different ways of looking at the value of exposure from a live stream in comparison to a video on demand. But it's very fascinating, and the subscriber network and there's a lot of layers that come along with it. And we're just in the very beginning phases.
A quick follow-up. You talked about the importance of APIs for the social platforms. I assume there's the same kind of situation with the esports platforms. And if so, if that's true, does Fortnite have an API?
Yeah, so Fortnite, they don't have an API to my knowledge for us to process the information in that capacity. And a lot of times you look at like how LinkedIn did their strategy with not giving out a lot of their data. You could publish to LinkedIn, but you don't want to give it out. That data is extremely valuable, and they're using it in ways to better engage their audience. There's this argument in the esports world that developers like Epic Games or Blizzard and Activision look at esports as a marketing play for them. And so it's tough for the teams to really generate a lot of value and grow. And so we're now seeing this trend of communities that are being built around esports. So while there might not be an API around that direct platform, but they do provide versions of the games that could be used in tournament-like styles. For Call of Duty, you can use the same like game types of what the tournament people are using. And so with that, there's APIs on Twitch, there's APIs on YouTube, there's APIs and bots on Discord that are being used to provide help and information around it. But it is certainly fascinating. And right now, a lot of the people in esports are arguing that is where 18 to 34 year olds are primarily on the male side are interacting and engaging with more than any other sport that's out there and growing increasingly. And this new generation, I'm not going to be surprised if we're going to bars and there's going to be video games playing, people competitively playing sports as opposed to us going and seeing baseball that we're typically kind of used to or basketball on the screen. So it's definitely different, what's awesome about it is anyone can kind of, but the way these guys train is just like an athlete too. And they, their age of when they come in and come out is a much lower age. So you're seeing a lot of them come back as analysts or hosts on shows and stuff like that, or the tournaments, or even creating these communities and ecosystems where they're producing these. But I'm very excited to see these kind of communities come out where there's Vindex that are putting these production shows around these shows. There's Venn, mm-hmm. V-E-N-N. Mm-hmm. And so this is yeah, and this is like Fox Sports. This is like the RSN, right? This is there's a lot of comparisons that you can look at from sports and media and broadcasting that are now happening with esports, but it's just being done at such a high speed level.
Yeah, Tom and I can think back to the days of pinball in bars. Now people are walking and just play World of Warcraft on their phone against everybody else.
Yeah.
Amir, we want to segue from your business to the board position that you have with WIST. We, as Tom mentioned at the beginning of the show, we haven't ever really talked about women in sports and technology. We certainly would love to have somebody on to talk a little bit more about it, but can you open the door for us? Tell us about WIST, how you got involved, what exactly it's doing, and what the vision is overall.
Yeah, absolutely. No. So basically, We had a terrible ratio at Zimf, right? And it's sports tech, and it's typically there's not a lot in sports, there's not a lot in tech, and it's even harder in sports tech to find female applicants. And I got tired of excuses that we weren't getting enough applicants. So I reached out to, I heard about WIST through a podcast on the Core podcast with Russell Scabretti when he was hosting it. Now he's at the New York Giants. And Netta Tabii, she did an interview there. She's on this, San Jose Sharks. And she mentioned it.
They worked together at Core. That's where they first met.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. So it's just small. Okay. So I heard her and I loved her philosophy and her data-driven approach. And I was like, okay, what is WIST? I've never heard of this. And so I reached out. An amazing lady, Gretchen Reeves, started interacting with me. And they put our jobs up on their job serve and on their listserv, and other people can do that too, so you can get female applicants. A lot of great companies are involved, MBA, WNBA, Nike's heavily involved with the WIST program, and there's more and more organizations coming through. But I just got so impressed with this group of people and what they're building and what they're achieving. And I started, assisting them with social media advice and ways of how to amplify it. Became a board advisor through some of the interactions that we've been doing. The founder, Mary Lou McFarland, just amazing person, understands the sports tech industry and ecosystem. I've gotten a lot of advice from all of them on our own organization. And it just doesn't make sense. I mean, you want as much diversity as possible, so the best ideas are being surfaced and there's room at the table for everyone. And so, this group is, what they're doing is they're highlighting and helping women find roles and leadership positions. And they've got a fellowship program as well. So we were able to bring two fellows onto, intern with us over the summer at the beginning of the pandemic. It was crazy because it was interns for the first time that wouldn't be in person with us and Zoom, Sydney Dotson and Mir Shao, and they're fantastic. They're phenomenal. And they one came from GW, one came from University of San Francisco, and there's all different types of tech that's involved, whether it's sport tech with the sports analytics, with performance, with the athletes and their bodies, whether it's, what we're doing with sponsorships, or, whether it's an organization like Nike or the NBA, right? So there's tons of amazing women that are involved with this program, and the community is growing every day, and more organizations are coming together. So, people are investing into becoming members of WIST or organizations that are becoming sponsors of it, and they're assisting with finding talent that's out there and students that are coming in. Incredibly sharp people that are looking for positions within sports tech. And I've just, I'm so fortunate to work with them. They've been inspiring to me and helped us with our ratio and helped us with how we think and helped us, position ourselves to be more applicable to women that are coming out of these amazing programs to want to apply to a company like ours.
So before we leave talking about WIST and get to some of our questions before we let you go, is it kind of a a repository for organizations to come together who have women interested in sports tech, because there's Girls in Drone Racing. There's, you know, Shia's does stuff with girls who are interested in STEM. And is it, it sounds like it's a little bit more senior people. Are there opportunities for young women and young girls to get involved as well? And then how much of that ties over when you think about tech? But is it, you know, if you have young women who aspire to be the general manager of the Washington Nationals, is it, you know, on kind of the Moneyball side as well? Does it encompass everything? That would be the question.
Yeah, no, that's great. So it's basically women in the front office that interact with technology, and there's men involved as well. And we definitely need as many male allies within the program and helping propone and bring awareness to it. So basically, it's women of leadership roles. They're doing leadership interviews. You need to see it to believe you can become it. And so there's a lot of executive women that are coming and sharing their stories of how they got to where they are. There's webinars, I believe, every other Friday that are going on right now where, you know, women from Twitch and women in gaming are getting involved, from the sports teams themselves, on the high executive level of organizations. And so it's all different ranges. Netta understands the impact where she's going into high schools and speaking, and knows that's when the biggest impact can be made, because a lot of women don't think that there is an opportunity for them in sports. And you're seeing these comments with like the distraction, right? And so a lot of women are now tweeting, where like, you know, we're not a distraction in sports teams. And that's absolutely the case. And so this is, it's centered around tech, but there's marketing tech, there's business research and AI, there's sponsorship tech. So as long as technology is a component of it, that's the one unifier. But there's women from HR related that are helping people that are finding opportunities as well. It's a community. And so it's just not one specific thing, but the mission is, you know, men and women helping changing the ratio at these organizations. And so it's just, and there's a lot of mentorship capabilities for younger women to come in. So the fellowship program is amazing. There's, if you go to their website, which is womeninsportstech.org, there's a fellowships page. And people are submitting themselves to be students. And there's a number of companies that are being hosts. And what WIST will do is they'll help facilitate and pay for that experience for these interns and fellows to go work at these organizations and get really great working experience and grow their network.
Great.
Wow. Good for you for doing that. Really, really good cause. Glad you're involved. Joe and I actually got to meet Mary Lou Amir Beck, pre-lockdown. Our last social event of perhaps 2021 was when Joe and I were at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference.
Oh, wow.
The meetup group we're involved with, NYBC Sports, hosted a party on Friday night, and I had invited my old friend Elise Soule. I don't know if you met Elise. I know she's friends with Mary Lou. She used to be at the NHL, a longtime sports business executive. So she was there and she said, do you mind if I bring my friend? And it was Mary Lou. I never met Mary Lou, and I didn't frankly know anything about WIST. And I learned about it that night for the first time. So that was awesome.
Yeah, that's so cool to hear. And I'm relatively new. This all happened in February, and I've just been
buying it. Oh, nice. That's actually when our thing was. That's when our party was.
They invited me, but I wasn't at Sloan. But like, I wish I was, because I would have met you guys there too. But it's a phenomenal group, and the Nina Luker, who is the other co-founder, she's in remission now from cancer, and she just beat it, and she's got an amazing experience on TikTok. But just such a impactful group. Jessica, David, Sydney, Lydia, from all different types of organizations, I've just been really wowed. So I'm trying to bring my knowledge of marketing and social media and help bring more awareness to what they are doing. But it's amazing to see the change just from when I joined and how many people are kind of, you know, rallying to this cry.
Amir, if Joe and I know of companies that are recruiting, would they take job postings for their site? I wasn't quite clear how they're doing the job posting thing.
Yeah, so during the pandemic right now, they're providing an opportunity for people to post their jobs for free. In the past, what they've done was, I think there was like a nominal charge, and that mm-hmm. money would go towards one of the fellowships to help another student get an opportunity. Right. But it's a very curated list of individuals of young, you know, of all different ages of women that are in sports tech. So that'll be seeing these. And so that'll help change the ratio with ensuring that
you're good
quality women. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. That's terrific. And we'll include in the show notes the information on list. womeninsportstech.org is the website, and on social, it's what, at, I know I've seen the account, but I just refresh my memory. What's the Twitter account?
Yeah, I believe it's the Twitter and Instagram are a little bit different, but it's women sports tech. So one S, okay. Between women and sports, but, and then the Twitter is women in sports tech.
Okay, good. Thank you. So, Joe, are we ready to move on to the big questions?
Yeah.
Wrap-up questions?
Our last.
All right.
Go ahead. You go, Tom.
Yeah. We gave you fair warning, Amir, so hopefully you have a really good answer for both these. But first, let's start with knowledge curation. How do you stay smart? What are you reading? What are you listening to? Who are you following? What's up?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm always, Twitter is my number one go-to in LinkedIn, and I create my list. I've got a sports biz Twitter list that you can look at. You guys are definitely on there, right? I've curated some of the best people in the business. I'm always paying attention to the top content that's coming out. I like to read SBJ, you know, Front Office Sports, Hashtag Sports, Sports Pro, Sports Geek, the podcast and the newsletter. I'm all about the newsletters and the podcast right now and just listening in. And of course, this podcast.
Oh, cool. Thank you. That's nice. Joe, you want to finish it off?
Yeah. So you're obviously advising a lot of advisory boards. You're on a lot of advisory boards. You have a lot of young people around them. We have a lot of people, young people who listen, but also a lot of people in career transitions. You've had your ups and your downs. You've worked on a business, grown a business, pivoted the business. The question that always comes up is, what's the advice that you give to people who are either new to the business or transitioning into other businesses to help them kind of go to a next step?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic question. I think, you know, a lot of people have heard this, but it's disassociating the negativity with failure and looking at failure as progress and towards the goal that you're getting to. You know, there's books like Angela Duckworth and Grit, and grittiness is one of the most impactful features that you can have or characteristics. And that's something that you can grow and hone and build. But I constantly look at one, always learning. If, I've got a quote that everyone rolls their eyes at, but comfort is the enemy of greatness. And if you're ever comfortable, you're moving backwards. And in startup world, if you're neutral, you're moving backwards, right? So you've always have to aggressively move forward. So it's just by constantly learning, staying, you know, the question that right before this, always staying on top of your game, always learning what's new. The questions you guys are asking, I mean, like you guys are on the cutting edge and knowing what's impacting everything that's, you know, happening in sports today. Everyone's got to be on that mind state and see what that next thing is coming around the corner so that they're ready for it. And even if they do fail, you know, figure out how do you position what you've done and built to get to that point to reposition and attempt again.
So it's funny, Amir, even though you mentioned the Bulls when we started this, we're taping this towards the end of August and we just finished Mamba week. So you sound a lot like a lot of the things that Kobe Bryant, you know, espoused throughout his career about never giving up, striving. And it's funny, I actually have here on my floor, the Mamba mentality, which my friend Andy Bernstein took all the pictures for. And last week was 8/24, which was Kobe Bryant day. And it, you know, it's interesting how that, even in the world we're in right now, his kind of philosophy and the way he played and the way he lived resonates now more in a pandemic and in a bubble than it did probably when he passed away earlier this year, or certainly, you know, as things were kind of playing out at the end of his career. So, you know, a little bit of Mamba thrown in addition to the last dance for you.
I love his tenacity and relentlessness, and you couldn't have brought up a better example of grit personified.
Yeah, Kobe, when I was at the Sixers, as before we let you go, you know, I have vivid memories of Kobe literally sitting at my desk when he was 15 years old, because he was around the team the whole time when our offices were in the basement of the Vet. So, you know, it was nice to be at that point, and his original strength coach, Joe Carbone, became a really good friend of mine. And, you know, to now get to mom, but we can hear you echo those thoughts without even thinking about it is, you know, it's pretty important. And by the way, for anybody who hasn't, you know, either picked up out of the library or checked out Mama Mentality, you know, it's certainly worth it. Short bursts of information, but you know, I you hope that people don't forget now, you know, kind of what Kobe built way beyond, you know, basketball for, you know, a mentality and how you kind of succeed in life. And I think a lot of people are going to need that stuff going forward now as we kind of go into a fall, which is going to have tremendous transition and upheaval in our business.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah, I'll just respond quickly, Joe, to that. I'm glad you brought it up as an add-on to Amir's comments. It's starting to feel to me like, in a funny way, despite Michael's greatness and LeBron's greatness, like Kobe's package, like the overall impact, actually may be his biggest, like the biggest legacy left by an NBA player of the 21st century. Am I overstating that? Just feels like,
no, I think it, you know, and you it's know, interesting. There's a great Howard Beck at Bleacher Report just did, he has a podcast called The Full 48. And one of the last ones he did, was with, Brendan, I'm going to screw up his first name. I think it's Brendan Gassaway, who's now the chairman of the DNC, the head of PR for the DNC, Democratic National Committee. And he is was a Kobe devotee and talked a lot about how he was able to apply a lot of the things growing up that Kobe did. But the biggest thing that Kobe did that LeBron has not done with the Lakers is Kobe had the rings. And, you know, as a diehard Lakers fan, he turned around and said, you know, until LeBron gets the rings, he doesn't belong in the rafters, because that's the level that has been set with the Lakers as opposed to other franchises where, you know, you're really good and you get a ring. It's like, really, I think the Lakers, Yankees and the Cowboys are probably the three where unless you win a title, you know, you're considered good, but not great or immortal. And I'll give you one last example of kind of that mentality, and it's actually UCLA. You know, I don't know if everybody knows, but UCLA only hangs banners for teams that win championships. And when I was at the Knicks and Larry Brown was the coach, we went to practice at Pauley Pavilion one day, and he obviously, he didn't follow. You know, he was, I think three coaches removed, but Coach Wooden was still alive and was in the office. And they were meeting one day and Coach Wooden came down to the floor and he pointed up at the ceiling in front of all the writers. And he said, you know, Coach Brown, you know, maybe you'll be able to get up there someday like I am. And he just kind of walked away and Larry Brown turned, you know, that's the mentality that he had. And, you know, and only one other coach has ever been able to do it there. So, but that's, you know, two dynamic basketball franchises, if you can call UCLA a franchise, which you can, you know, in the same city with kind of the same mentality. And I'm sure, you know, John Wooden and Kobe Bryant, you know, for their careers and what they did after their careers, even though Kobe's was way too short, are very similar. So
If you're going to compare yourself to anyone, compare yourself to a giant.
Yeah. Good point. So nice. Not Michael Strahan.
On that note. Yeah. Amir, thank you so much. Everybody, we've been listening to Amir Zanozi, who's the co-founder and president of Zoomf, and also a board member of Women in Sports Tech. And it's been a really enjoyable and informative conversation. So on behalf of Columbia and Joe, Amir, thank you so much for spending time with us. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you. The pleasure's mine, guys.
Hey, before we let you go, where do people follow you, and
where does everybody find you? Because they probably should find you on the internet.
Yeah, so I'm Zanozi everywhere, Zonozi on all the social networks, and then Zoomph is Zoomph, and then Women in Sports Tech is at Women in Sports Tech. So all pretty easy, but looking forward to gauging. If I can help in any way, don't hesitate to reach out.
Yeah, well, when we finally get back to on-campus activities, open invitation to you to visit our classes, our program. It'd be great to have you. It's a really relevant and really important topic, and quite relevant to most of the classes at the program right now. So someday, maybe 2022, 2023,
something say like that, Joe. What do you think? Yeah, take a rain check for the Columbia Sports Business Conference in October of 2022.
Yeah, okay, I'll be there. I'm patient enough.
Just follow Joe the next few weeks to make sure we can get through 2021, because he's going to be going to the campus, unlike the rest of us.
Awesome.
All right,
awesome.
Joe, you want to wrap?
Yeah, once again, this has been the Cusp Show for our guest Amir Zanozzi. I'm Joe Favorito, our producer Tom Cerny, and Tom Richardson. And by the way, we want to mention before we go, for anybody who noticed the audio change a little bit, in the middle of this, and we did not stop, Tom Richardson lost power in Connecticut and was able to dial back in after we were texting back and forth. So once again,
about the Mamba mentality. I had to lose my Wi-Fi and use my AT&T signal, but it actually worked this time.
Yeah.
So whatever it takes, Joe.
Yep. Anyway, on a stormy day in Connecticut for Tom, once again, I'm Joe Favorito for Tom Richardson. This is the Cusp Show, and we'll see you down the road.